Hello, everybody. This is Steve Ellis. I'm on Cattails. Check it out because it's a good show.
You're listening to Cattails.
Hi, I'm Cat, and you're listening to Cattails. Steve Ellis is the great white of soul singers who fronted 60s mod pop soul group Love Affair, best remembered for their stunning singles Rainbow Valley, Bringing On Back the Good Times, and of course the smash hit Everlasting Love, which became one of the defining songs of its era. Post Love Affair, Steve had more chart hits with Widowmaker. Now Brighton based, well, where else, has since forged out a successful solo career and is about to release a 10 CD box set. We chat about the forthcoming release, pop sensation Love Affair organising a tribute concert in memory of the late Steve Marriott, and how he once got arrested. This is The One with Steve Ellis.
Tell me how is your health, because you've had a little bit of a hard time, haven't you, recently, and it's interfered with your touring and stuff. So how are you feeling?
Yeah, not bad. A bit sort of my chest. What happened was the end of the tour we did last was 2019 into 20, and then I had this terrible cough, couldn't get rid of it, and my right hand man, who drives me about, does all that admin, Kev, my mate. He plays on records as well. He got it as well. He was in bed for a week, and I think it's possible that we had COVID.
Yeah.
But no doctor that I've seen, and I've seen specialists and everything about it all, has been able to answer that, because it's too long, like when I eventually went to the doctor.
Yeah.
It was too long to be able to diagnose it, you know, say that's what it was, but sort of left me with a really sore chest and feeling a bit rough. And then I sort of took the view that I better get investigated. So without boring you to death, I had like cameras down my throat and up my nose and all kinds of, you name it, CTs, MRIs, the rest, blah, blah, blah. And so I sort of got a bit of a bad chest. But my voice box is all good. Been in a studio recently to do some recording. And that's that sort of side of it. But with the tour, I just sort of looked at it long and hard, well in advance of it kicking off. And I thought, well, I'm not confident because I haven't been singing for the lockdown and everything. I've been singing for, 18 months.
Yeah.
I just thought, I don't really want to go on tour, get 3 days into it, and then my voice always get a problem.
Yeah, that would be worse. Yeah.
Yeah, and then with all the variables anyway, with what's going on in the world and everything, I just phoned Robert up, the agent, and he was good. I said, Robert, I said, I'm not confident about all of this, and he knows, you know, obviously that I had a problem at the time, sort of, with it. And he just said, you've never let me down, you've always been nothing more than 100%, so fair dues, you know. So I gave him plenty of notice, you know. I felt a bit bad because I really didn't want to let anybody down, but then I've never done it before. I've never sort of fallen, pulled out of anything unless I've really had to.
Well, exactly. And it would have been worse, wouldn't it, to have actually gone and not been on your game, because that would have been a disappointment from your perspective. You'd have always been saying to yourself, I knew I wasn't 100% and I knew I couldn't give it my best. And that, as a performer, that's not great, is it?
No, you're bang on. I mean, you know, I've always gone out there and given it 100 and never anything. Doesn't matter. I mean, it's getting pretty sort of cool for people to say, oh, I don't care if there's 10 people or 10,000, you know. But I've always had that. That's always been my take on it forever. It doesn't matter if there's 3 people with a dog, they're still going to get it because they've come to see me play, you know.
Oh, absolutely. They deserve your best performance, and you deserve to give your best performance because that's what you're in the business for, isn't it?
Absolutely, 100%. So that's my answer to that. I just thought, no, you've got to be sensible, you know. And you know, none of us are 21 anymore.
No.
And, you know, those tours Oh, I mean, people think you land from a spaceship on the stage. It doesn't actually work like that. You're sort of running around the motorways for 3 months, up and down here, there and everywhere, getting back at silly o'clock, you know, getting up and starting again. And, yeah, I've done it, and I will do it again, but it's not a life of luxury.
No, it's not, is it? It's hard work.
Well, sitting on the M25 in a traffic jam, even if it's a summer, which we've had 5-6 hours waiting at Heathrow because of a fatality, unfortunately, for people, but it impacted on you know, getting to the venue and everything, and it knocks everything out of kilter, and people think you aren't going to turn up. And you know, I've even had one case where played a festival in Nottingham, and we were like a bat out of hell. It might have been that day actually, and we got to the signpost for the place, and Kev, as I mentioned, went to do a right into Loughborough. I said, "Don't take that," and I'm no good. I'm the worst driver. I don't drive. I'm the worst navigator as well. So I said, "Kev, trust me, go left," and he did, thank God. And we hit the showground, and it was in a front gate, past security. Security bloke jumped in the car, landed on my lap. I said, "Take us to the stage," you know. Got straight there, get out of the car, splashed myself all over in a cold water. Stan pumps things,
yes,
whatever
yeah.
they are.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, took my shirt off and stood there, splashed cold water all over me, threw my clothes back and you know, my stage thing on, and went on straight on stage. For about three numbers, I didn't know where I was. It was like, what is it? Like, just totally disorientated.
It felt like the 60s again.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was kind of weird, that one. But I think next autumn, not, you know, the one we just passed by, obviously, I think maybe we might be in a place a whole lot better, you know, or certainly even the summer. But I think we're in for a rough ride in the winter. People just seem to think it's over, and it's not over.
Well, as long as we don't go back into that lockdown, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, that really just put paid to everything, didn't it? I mean, did you do any sort of writing in during that time, or what did you do to spend get through the days?
In lockdown, I thought, well, I can't go out and gig, which is what, you know, very frustrating when you're used to doing that. But I had to do it, so I thought, right, I've got to do something. So I've done quite a lot, actually. The most sort of positive was, I put an album out, must have been February this year. Yeah, I think, where are we now? Yeah, February this year.
Mm-hmm.
On Demon, which is it's a BBC, and that made the charts, the vinyl charts.
Yeah.
So I had a hit record for the first time for 15 years.
I know. I read this. I was going to ask you just about that. How did that feel? It was almost like stepping back in time for you, wasn't it?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I'm lucky. I say I'm lucky. I very appreciate the fact that I've got a good sort of amount of followers.
Yeah.
I don't buy this fan. I don't like fan. The word fans necessarily don't really sit well with me. It never has. So I'm fortunate that I've got a kind of a following. And bless them, I went out and bought it. And a lot of other people bought it. Good reviews. Good PR man on it and so forth to let people know it was out. You know.
Yes.
And then the chart thing came out that week, and I think it was number 14 or 17. I can't remember which it was. And my mate Stuart, PR guy, said, "You won't believe this. What was it?" I went, "Really?" And I sort of went, "Oh, well, good enough then. Thanks, Stu." That was like, what's next?
Yeah.
So then what happened was, because it was a kind of a best of Love Affair / Me Solo. And we put quite a bit of work into putting it together, you know, what tracks we were going to choose, you know, additionals and what. And so, of course, that did pretty well in the scheme of things because of the state of the industry at the moment.
Yeah.
I spoke to the guy that was like head of sort of the department that dealt with that at the record label, and I said, my sort of fellow that helps about the business sort of stuff, Pete, the mate, he says, ask him to do one of their box sets, CD box sets. So I phoned up Ben at Demon, and I said, Ben, what about doing one of your, they got this thing where they do a 3-CD box set.
Yeah.
And I said, what about doing a 3-CD box set? And he went, oh, no. I went, oh, God, that's gone down well, isn't it? He went, no, he said, I want you to do an 8-CD. I went, hey, what? He says, yeah, in fact, no, do what you want. So I went, really? So we ended up with 10. We could have probably had 12, but we stuck at 10 viable for them, you know, because they have to cost everything out.
Of course, yeah.
So we stuck at 10, and I've sort of been working on trawling tracks and then getting hold of the people, in tandem with, obviously, with them, because they have to tie everything down with the legals. And then I've got older mates, and they go, no, I don't want to sign off. What do you want to sign off? I said, I have to have a sign off, because it's the record label asking for sign offs, you know, for permission to use, so to speak. So I did some tracks. I did Steve Barrett Memorial Concert way back 2000. Long story, but Dean and I, rest in peace, Powell, the boxing promoter, has passed away. Dean phoned me and said, oh, could we perhaps do a memorial concert for Steve Barrett? And I said, yeah. I said, nobody's ever done anything, you know, properly for him. So we started off at the Ruskin Arms in East Ham, in the East End, where the band started.
Brilliant.
And it was rammed, and there's, you know, coaches coming in, and you couldn't get enough people in it. And it went really well, so it sort of rolled over into the next year, and I said to Dean, you know, I'm not really comfortable doing this anymore. I've done it for the reasons I wanted, you know, which was to give him a heads up, you know, give him a tip of hat to Steve, you know.
Yeah.
And the upside of it was I met his mum and his sister and his little son, nephew, and became big friends with them. So they remain to this day, apart from Kay, who made 90. She was a wonderful, wonderful woman. And it rolled over and it ended up at the Astoria, which has now been knocked down in Shaftesbury Avenue in London.
Yeah.
And turned into this amazing concert with, like, Jerry Shirley, who was the drummer in Humble Pie.
Yeah.
With Steve Barrett's band. Jerry's been a mate of mine since we were kids. We used to play together when we were 16. So Jerry phoned me up, said, do you want to do this thing? I said, yeah, Dean told me. He said, can you help me sort of put the bill together? So we sort of spent a few hours, well, quite a lot of time on the phone discussing it.
Yeah.
And we ended up with, let's see where we got to. We got Steve, we got Mac from Small Faces and Kenny Jones from Small Faces. And we got Noel and Jem from Oasis. This is working out top backwards. Then we got Paul Weller, but he's a mate of mine anyway. He'd done it anyway. Paul, Humble Pie, Peter Frampton came over from America. Obviously Jerry on drums. Debbie Bonham band.
Yeah.
Then there was a lot of other bands that had played the original. When we did the very, very first one, a lot of young bands that, and maybe not so young bands, that had done the original couple, which had done money, nobody got paid for anything. So we pulled in quite a few of those bands as well, because we we thought it was only fair that as they jumped in the first instance, they should be included in the one that sort of turned into the, like the big one, and it was videoed and filmed and recorded and all the rest of it, and put out double, triple CD, whatever, I can't remember, and the video. So I was trying to track that down, and it turned out to be Debbie Bonham. Her husband had filmed it all and done everything, and I got hold of Pete, and we had a chat, and Pete worked with Jerry, so it's all wheels within wheels.
Yeah.
Pete was in the band with Jerry Shirley as well, so Jerry said, "Dad, just ring Pete up." I said, "Well, I met Pete, but I don't really know him." I phoned him up, and I said, "Pete, I would like those three tracks from the Astoria." He said, "Yeah, of course, yeah, of course, what's it for?" I told him. He said, "But I have to have a fee." So I went, "Okay, I'll give you £1.
Yeah.
He said, "All right."
Cheap, half the price, eh?
No, you have to do that.
You do.
You have to do that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I got those tracks and a whole load more, a whole absolute piles of tracks on 10 CDs. So I'm still working on it this morning.
Absolutely.
With the guy at the record label. So, that'll be out probably next April, May, I should think. Been in the studio with Paul Weller. I have to say Weller, I don't know what I'm talking about. He's been a mate of mine for 30 more years. We talked about it the other day, couldn't believe it.
Oh, don't talk about time going by. It's so quick, isn't it?
It's scary, right?
It is.
What it is. And Paul said, "Why don't you do a bonus track for the box set?" Well, if you're up for it. So in the lockdown, he sent me on the computer. Well, I don't like it because you can't judge what you're doing on a computer. So I've got Charles, his engineer, stroke right-hand man up at the studio to burn me off CD.
Yeah.
And I worked on that, worked on the lyric and everything else, and got that done and dusted. Then got some time when studio wasn't busy, and went in with Paul and the usual crew, basically the crew that played on I had an album out a couple of years ago called Boom Bang Twang, and that was with Paul, two boys at the Moons, Ben the drummer, he's become a good mate of mine. Then you've got Kev, my right hand man, playing Hammond and what have you. And Charles, and I didn't miss anybody out. Who else was there? Lots of people were putting in bits and pieces, you know. And that did all right. That album did all right. That was on Sony. So, yeah, that was way back. So that crew played on the bonus track, minus Andy, because Andy couldn't make it, sadly. Call them Black Barn Crew is what I call them. And then we had, we called in a super sub. We called in Steve from, was the original member of the Jam with right way back in the beginning, Steve Brooks, lovely guy.
Yeah.
And fantastic guitar. I've never met him before. And he turned up, plugged in, played along, and superb.
Blimey.
There's a track called Lonely No More, which I sort of did as a homage to sort of, although they use the word a lot, Northern Soul. Northern Soul, to my way of thinking, is just 60s soul, but in the 70s, when all the guys used to go talcum powder the floor and dance, go to the all-nighters. And there's a record we used to play that I love by Frank Wilson called Do I Love You, Indeed I Do.
Mm-hmm.
Do I Love You? That one, that's a fabulous record. Thought, well, I've got to write something like that. So we wrote Lonely No More. Kind of not like it, but in that ilk, because I wanted to write something like that. And everybody loved it, so we put it out as a single.
Must have said
Hello everybody, this is Steve Ellis. I'm on Cattails. Check it out because it's a good show.
It's wonderful, isn't it, that you get your mates together and then they bring their other mates and then you're suddenly into a situation where you're all in the studio doing stuff. And does it rely on you having that instant connection with them to really produce something great, or is it just you just go for it and it is what it is?
Well, I think in these instances, certainly lately, recording at the barn, especially with Paul, I mean, Paul's just totally into what he does 101%, and why not? That's what you should be, you know.
Yeah.
And had a bit of a lucky strike on the PR fund.
Amazing.
There's a film coming out called Belfast.
Oh, yes.
And I've seen the trailer for it. There's a trailer on YouTube because somebody told me about it. Kenneth Branagh produced it and he's in it, and I think he's in it, and Judy Dench.
Yeah.
Should I, how dare you forget my name?
She would, wouldn't she?
Yeah, how very dare you. She's in it, and I know there are other guys that I wouldn't profess that I actually have heard of, because I'm not a big movie buff. I just like stuff that turns up, you know, I don't go looking for it. But I've seen this and it looks like it's going to be a big hit, I think. And I was there, the band Love Affair were there when all the big troubles went off again, because it's been going on for years, and sorry I'm going to get into with you about, I mean, I went to school with Irish kids,
yeah.
And my mates, you know, boxing club and everything. Nobody has ever explained to me what exactly it's all about, but the riots all went off, and we were there, and we had guns coming through the car windows on the checkpoints, and who are you, where are you going, and then we said to the Irish tour manager, can we go out, we're in Belfast, can we go out and have a look around? And they went, you must be joking, you know. I said, why? He said, you're English. I went, yeah, well, we're just out of school, you know.
Yeah.
We're sort of 17, you know. But what? You can't go out. It's not safe. But we couldn't understand it. I still really don't understand it to this day. But I mean, it runs deep, so I'm not going to get myself in trouble about it, you know. But anyway, this film looks to be fabulous, I think, and it's got some Everlasting Love. Hanging over my head, sort of Damocles.
Yes.
As like a theme running through, from what I can gather. And, thank you very much. I can't knock that record because it served me very well. And
well, it's such an iconic track, isn't it? And I think it's always going to be there. And when I speak to people who've had such a defining moment, I think, in their career, they find it's like a double-edged sword, isn't it? On one hand, it's absolutely fabulous. But on the other hand, it's, you know, you want to be known for your other stuff as well, don't you?
Absolutely, 100%. But the thing is, I mean, we started out as kids, still at school, we'd play anywhere. We, you know, I've said this 100 times, you know. We would play anywhere. Mm. We had a place to rehearse. We had the luxury of a place. We used to rehearse in a factory. And we had a driver with a transit because he worked at the factory. And the manager said, right, you're running the boys about. So we would have spotters everywhere. You know, oh, there's a party on. Oh, there's a youth club. Oh, there's a this, there's a that. And we just take off. And we built this following up in London. Then the word spread out. And we ended up playing like Manchester, Southend, Margate, all over the place. Just 5 blokes with a driver in a van.
Yeah.
And we just take off. Because you get back at like 3 o'clock in the morning, you have to get up for school.
And, like, crazy.
No, it's mad. But it was brilliant.
Yeah.
And then and there was a club in London called The Flamingo.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very famous sort of blues R&B club.
Yeah.
And anybody back in the day would remember those people that used to play there, people like Georgie Fame and the Blue Flames, Gina Washington and the Ram Jam Band, Zoot Money and the Big Roll Band, Sonny Child, TNT, and that, we were there. So we were 16 years old.
Wow.
And you know, it was predominantly black GIs and mods, you know, hardcore mods. And we were told by the management, if anybody asks you, right, don't tell them how old you are.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're so naive. We're going, why? You know, because we lose our license, sonny boy. And we're like, what's a license? Right, mister, what's a license? You know. But we did all right. We went down well. When we went back, I think we played there twice. So that was quite an achievement for us. But I think we were a bit of a novelty because it was like these snotty little kids up on stage, you know.
Yeah.
I think they found that quite amusing.
Yeah.
But, you know, we sort of got better and we got better and we got better and we kept playing and we just got better and better. And then all of a sudden we had all this interest from different... We used to have people like Kenny Lynch used to come down to rehearsals.
Okay.
All different people used to come to rehearsals to turn up just to watch us. And then we went in the studio with Kenny. Then we went in the studio with Mike Vernon, who... we didn't realise, but he was like a big name in the blues world. You know, it was Fleetwood Mac and people like that. But, I mean, we didn't know. We were blissfully unaware who he was. He just seemed like a nice fellow. And we did this Dire record that died a death.
Oh, no.
Now fetches enormous amounts of money on eBay. And then at the rehearsals at the factory, we had 3 managers. Would you believe,
right,
at one time?
Blimey.
We had David Wedgbury from Decca, who was a house photographer, in-house photographer for Decca, and he shot the... he did some fantastic photos, but he shot the cover for My Generation, the Who cover.
Uh-huh, yes.
And, you know, that's really...
Iconic.
Really sort of well-known. Yeah,
yeah.
That is iconic.
Yeah.
And, of course, we're all taking it. Oh, that's the guy that took the cover of that, blah, 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 blah. You know. So they turned up and they'd bring these demos or records down that hadn't been released yet in England because they're on the Monument label in America.
Right.
So they had, because they worked at Decca, they had, like, first dibs. So they'd come in with stuff and they'd go, what's your fancy word? Oh, apart from stuff that they used to put in front and say, do you want to do that in the set? And we were like a mod soul band. We were a mod band, but we were like doing all like soul stuff, like Wilson Pickett, Marvin Gaye, Solomon Burke, Sam and Dave, Eddie Floyd. Mm. You know, you go through all them. We did all those numbers 3 times a night because sometimes we'd do 3 sets a night, 4 sets a night.
Yeah.
You know, 4 1-hour sets we used to do at one place in Southend, but we were 16 and bulletproof, you know.
Crikey.
Didn't matter much.
Exhausting.
Well, no, not when you're a kid. You sort of go out and go to school, you know.
That's
well, I did
true.
That last night. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so then they turn up with White A Shade of Pale one day.
Yeah.
This guy turned up. I think it was Matthew Fisher. I can't remember. This guy turned up, looked a bit of a hippie. And... we sort of looking at him, you know, like, it's a bit odd, isn't it, you know, and put the track on, you know. But we all thought it was amazing, and but it wasn't us. It wasn't for us, you know. It just wasn't our thing. And I just I was quite I've always been quite vocal about things, but I just said it's fantastic. I said we couldn't better that. There's no way that should come out. You know, that should come out on its own merit. And it did, and it's sort of stone cold classic, you know, Gary Wright's vocal and the whole thing and the Hammond organ and the whole thing is just a fantastic record. So we offered that somehow within the mists of time, you know, and I do remember that, and that's 100% factual. And then they turn up with Everlasting Love by Robert Knight, and I went, that's, I want that, can we do that? Yeah, right, okay. So we all trundled off to Island Studios with Muff Winwood from Spencer Davis Group.
Yes.
Muff's a lovely fella. And we did a version, but I've never heard it since. The manager decided it wasn't good enough. So I got packed off on my own with Keith Mansfield and his orchestra, which was all the top session players of the day, like Big Jim Sullivan, Clem Cattini on drums, who I thought was brilliant. All those guys, you know, and so there I am with this massive orchestrated track, and the producer, bless him, Mike Smith, said to me, just go out there and give it, you know, do what you do, you know. So I was a bit nervous, to be honest, because I'm young, and so he gave me a brandy, which I'd never had before, and I went out and I did. No, I never heard it. I went out and did the vocal in two takes, and that was it. And they played it back, and it sort of, I sort of listened to it, and I thought, you know, because we're trying to get this sort of almost like a wall of sound effect, you know, full effects of it. But not, it wasn't multi-tracked, it was just single tracks, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, somebody said to me, well, so what's the secret? And I said, well, first and foremost, it was a great song.
Yeah.
Secondly, it was a great arrangement. And thirdly, it was a great production. And that's the secret.
Yeah.
You know, it had the components.
How did the rest of the band feel when actually it was released and you were the only real member of Love Affair to perform on it? And were they sort of okay about that? I can imagine a few heckles up.
What I was going to say was more so the public, not so much the public as the press and stuff. Because I was going to tell you what happened was we had this PR guy, Brian Biffo, we used to call him, a lovely guy. He says, what you need is publicity stunt. Back in the day, well, they do it now, fake news. It's the same thing, fake news.
Yeah.
Only then you go and do some madcap bloody thing, you know. So it's November and we're in Piccadilly Circus with a photo shoot, you know. Oh, he says, I've got it, boys. Get up here, Ross, in Piccadilly Circus. We're going, no, it's the middle of winter, Brian. He said, yeah, but just go up to the first level and we'll take, you know, Eros, Statue of Love or whatever it is. You know what I mean, with a cupid on top with a bow and arrow.
Mm-hmm.
And we go, no, we can't do that, you know. So we get on the first level. And then one of them falls in, the drummer falls in, it's freezing cold. And then in my madness, I climb to the top.
Oh, no.
And, of course, it's all on tears like a bloody wedding cake. And, and the thing was, I got to the top and I couldn't get back down.
Oh, my God, Steve.
It was freezing cold and it was all slippery and slidey because, you know, obviously. And they called the fire brigade and the police and we all got arrested and taken off to West End Central and locked up.
Oh, no.
We're all in the cells down in the basement and I said, old man, river, that old man, river. It's all echoing round in there. And just shut up down there, you lot. That bloody, And so what happened was we went to court and we all got fined £12 each and bound over to keep the peace or something like that, and the whole thing was in all the newspapers, you know, my dad wasn't very happy about
it. No, I bet he wasn't.
Moving with mum. But it was in all, and we, because we're kids, you are oblivious to all this, you know.
Yeah.
You haven't woken up to the world yet, really.
No.
And, you know, so the base player put £60 down and to the desk sergeant, and he counts out. At £60, and that buys West End Central Police Station a year's supply of police truncheons and whistles. And he went mad, didn't he? He chased us out of the place. And in about three weeks later, for some reason, I don't know, because the record was going up the charts, I might even have gone to number one, I can't remember, but we ended up doing loads of TV shows. And we did a thing called the Jonathan King Show.
Yeah.
And Jonathan King always liked, you know, some sort of, like Malcolm McLaren move, you know. Trying to sort of get the best out of a situation. And so we did his show. We went on his show and then he's interviewing us. And he says to the bass player, straight up, it looks him straight in the eyes and he says, you didn't play on your record, did you? Just like that. And we all stood there like wrong footed, like
God.
You know. And so of course that all went across everywhere,
yeah.
There and everywhere. And we got labelled as like a manufactured band, you know, that only I was on the record, which is true, I was the only one on all the records.
Mm.
Because it was a formula and it works, you know,
yeah.
And
yeah.
So
it wasn't unusual, though, was it, at the time? There were quite a few bands that were like that, weren't there?
I could name half a dozen bands that are still about today, two or three of which are mega,
yeah.
You know, like worldwide known, that used to do it. But, you know, nothing was ever said about it. It was all kept under wraps, pretty much.
Yeah.
We took the cane for it. And it was a bit unfair because we gone out and played from 66,
yeah.
You know, and this is 68, so we've been out playing, sleeping in the back of the van,
yeah.
and all the rest of it, you know, so
yeah.
we sort of earned our stripes, as I always say, whereas now it's all this nonsense about, and I don't want to sound like a grumpy old man, but it's all about, you know, fake news, and I can't bear it, I can't bear it.
You got, we got all-
I'm on Cattails. Check it out.
It's funny looking back on these things, isn't it? Does it feel like yesterday when you're telling these stories, or does it feel a long time ago and things have changed dramatically for you?
I suppose the only I've never looked back. I've always kept going forward, and you know, I keep making new records, blah, blah, blah. Except for one time when I came off the road because I had a bad accident. I'd had enough of the music business because what I'd done was I'd worked really hard from, you know, being at school all the way through, right through till probably I was like 29 without a break. Thought about it long and hard. I mean, let down by so many people, mainly called managers, whereby, yes, you go out and you bust your nuts and they keep all the money.
Yeah. I've heard this so many times, Steve. It's a tragedy of the music industry, isn't it? Particularly in those days. It's just incredible.
All you want to do is make music, have a good time, you know.
Yeah.
And if you have other people that are supposed to take care of the business. And then, of course, when it comes to it, oh no, we haven't got it. And it's that, you know, a lot of my mates, you know, the same thing happens. Like Andy, good pal of mine, Amy and Corner, Small Faces, you know, all those sort of bands, all got robbed. We all got robbed. And the trouble is, you could never call it because there was no way you'd sort of give it a second thought. You were, oh well, that's done. I'll get another band together. So that's what I've always taken the view, just crack on, you know.
Yeah.
Crack on. So I had a break like 29. I was 29. Had a bad accident, so I was sort of out of the business for quite a while, and got match fit again, and went back on the road solid for 10 years, and I never made a record. And the actual truth of the matter is, I never thought about making another record.
Yeah.
We just went out in a van like I did when I was at school.
Yeah.
Five blokes, one driver and a PA, you know, with a PA man, obviously.
Yeah.
And we just played everywhere. And this went on for 10 years.
Wow.
Never thought about going in the studio.
It's funny, you went back to your roots, didn't you?
Well, it was just like I didn't think of it. And the only record that we actually did make, we used to do a club in Edinburgh for Palomuggle, Stuart, lovely guy Stuart, and he loved the band, and we used to get Celtic football players come down to see us, and we played this club, and it was storming, it was fantastic. And the trouble was we played it too many times one year, and we overcooked it, you know, but it was so good. We used to just, we're playing at Cavendish tonight. Anyway, we're at the Cavendish, and we used to go on about 12 o'clock at night. And a big club, massive club. And agent phones up about 8 o'clock. Says, Steve, what's the matter? Oh, can you do a live album tonight? I went, are you joking? Are you kidding me? He went, were you at the Cavendish? I said, yeah, we don't have a DAT player. We don't have anything. We've got nothing. We're winning magic out of the sky. So he said, well, can't you ask Stuart? So I said, I'll ask him. I said, but don't hold your breath. I said, it's like 8 o'clock, you know.
Yeah.
So come off the phone, said Stu. It's Barry, you just phoned up. I says, can we do a live album? How are we supposed to do a live album now? He says, leave it to me. So he's phoned around because he knows it. He's Edinburgh, you know, Scottish. Mm-hmm. He's Edinburgh man, knows everybody, well connected. Lo and behold, he gets it all in, sorted out. But it was on a DAT. DAT's old.
Yeah.
Old now,
yeah.
And so we had, like, went on, just recorded it. But the thing is, we didn't have any overhead mics, nothing. It was just, like, straight into the desk. And the guy that was a club sort of PA man, did it. And I heard it back, and I said, yeah, I said, it was, you know, the gig was good. I said, but it's not really representative because, you know, you can't tweak anything up, down, or anything. You can't hear the audience.
Yeah.
Sounds like there was 3 men and a dog that night, but there wasn't. There was more than that. But, I mean, it sounds like, but, so... Well, he says, yeah, but you should put it out. You haven't had a record out, you know. And I said, well, put it out, but only under the understanding it's £2.99. And he agreed. So, I mean, I'm talking about 1990, about 95, something like that. 1995, something like that. So he put it out, £2.99. So if anybody moaned about it, he would say, well, it's £2.99.
Yeah, what
would
you expect?
But I said... Yeah, that was the only sort of record that I made at that point that I can recall off the top of my head at the moment.
Amazing.
I've written loads and loads and loads of songs which are all demos. And
yeah.
A lot of them are on the box set.
Oh, wow. I mean, looking back at it, you've obviously got Everlasting Love there, Steve, haven't you, which is a defining moment. But are there any other specific tracks that you'd say, do you know what, that summarises my career, or that was a turning point for me?
I don't think... I'm never anything but honest, and in that respect, you know, I could never say there was anything more defining... than the obvious track,
yeah.
Because that track has always turned up. It's like this film now, it's turned up again, and yeah. I'm not knocking it. When we play it live, I always do it. I don't do jukebox. That is, I always say to any band I work with, I don't do jukebox.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not in the market for playing jukebox. You do it because you mean it. You do it because you feel it. You get out there and you give it to them, you know.
Yeah.
I've done various versions of it live because things take a life of their own, you know.
Yeah.
We don't sort of do an 8-minute boring version, and you know, but we have a precise version now that works, and the audience love it, and the audience all it breaks down at the end, and the audience all sing this particular part.
Yeah.
Like, on a good night, we don't lead them into it; they just do it, and it's like
brilliant.
You can't explain the feeling when you've got a couple of thousand people singing the part of the song that you haven't necessarily got them to do. They've just done it, and it's magical. It's magical, and I love it.
Brilliant.
But I can't really say that there's any other number. I mean, yeah, I've made some good songs. You know, I've recorded some good songs. But I mean, you know, Eddie Hinton's... There's Muscle Shoals rhythm guitarist, you know, if you got it all technical about it. And I trawled through his catalogue and I found this fantastic track and recorded it. But, I mean, it didn't get radio played or anything, but, I mean, I love that song. When I was in the rock band Widowmaker, we toured America and everything, and they loved, you know, they loved us in America, but we were out of the loop in England. We did the big sort of tours, two or three of them before we went to America.
Yeah.
You know, there's a couple of numbers that we did then that are sort of defining to me, but not necessarily to that anybody here would go, oh, yeah, I love that.
I know exactly what you mean. So what's next for you then? Tell me what you're looking forward to, because you've done so much. You know, you've got your box set coming out in April or so. Let's hope it's, you know, then. You know,
yeah.
Would you like to go back on tour when you're feeling better?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's the plan. We've got some dates coming for December, which have been in the book for a while, and then they start back February, March, April, May, June.
Mm-hmm.
God willing, we'll see what occurs.
Excellent. Thank you so much for that, Steve. That's been an absolute joy.
No, it's lovely talking to you. Absolutely lovely talking to you.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Bye, Kat. I'll see you soon, all right?
Thank you for listening to Kat Tales with me, Kat, and my guest today, Steve Ellis. The tracks featured are Lonely No More from Boom Bang Twang and Hit the Spot from Ten Commitments. For more information about Steve and his music, visit steveellis.co.uk, and to listen to this again and to other tales, visit cattales.co.uk.
You've been listening to Cat.